Science is still looking for a cure for multiple sclerosis. While that search goes on, researchers look for ways to make life better for the people who have MS. Oregon Health Sciences University in Portland, otherwise known as OHSU, devotes an entire center to multiple sclerosis treatment and research. A lot of the work there focuses on diet. Adjustments to what MS patients eat can apparently make a big difference. Let's find out more from Dr. Vijay Yadav at Oregon Health Sciences University. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, Jeff. Good morning.
Good morning. Would you give us the outline of multiple sclerosis and what it does to the body over time?
Sure. So multiple sclerosis is a neurological disorder which affects brain, optic nerve, which is the eye, the nerve which connects the eye to the brain, and the spinal cord. So that leads to symptoms which can be quite disabling, such as vision loss, paralysis, sensory symptoms, control of bladder and bowel dysfunction, imbalance. So it's quite, it can be quite disabling, you know, when it affects the patients.
So basically everything involving nerves, which is pretty much everything in the body.
I would say yes.
Yeah. Okay. So what therapies are now available and how much have they changed or perhaps improved over time?
So I think the great thing about MS management now is we have more than 14 or almost 14 disease-modifying therapies, as we call, for multiple sclerosis. And the first one was approved by FDA in 1993. So that was the beta-seron. And since then, we have made huge leaps in how we manage patients with these drugs. So that's a huge, and we have made a huge change in our patients' life by use of these disease-modifying therapies. But at the same time, you know, there are quite a few things which are not adequately addressed by these disease-modifying therapies. So there is a lot of sort of this gap that needs to be bridged, and that's where we want to have other aspects of MS that, you know, we need to understand better and, like, you know, and try to target those.
So when you talk about the disease-modifying therapies, I mean, they don't obviously do they put MS in full remission or something close to it?
Some of them can actually put the disease into remission quite effectively, but majority of them are not going to control the disease 100%. So they are still called partially effective therapies, but they can be quite effective in many patients. So I think overall we have really seen a big change in how patients do now with the disease-modifying therapies versus when there were no disease-modifying therapies.
Dr. Yadav, how much do these therapies cost? I understand some of the medications are fairly expensive.
They are, actually. They can be quite expensive. Of course, you know, insurance can cover some of it, but then there are, on an average, I think the average cost of disease-modifying therapies is approaching anywhere $50,000 to $60,000 per year, and some of them can cost up to $100,000 or so each year.
Wow, and so insurance can cover some of that, but wow, that's a lot of expense for insurer or patient to pick up.
Absolutely.
Beyond costs, are there other issues with the medications, the therapies now in use?
So many of the therapies which are very effective, unfortunately, can also have pretty significant side effects. And as we know, MS is an immune disease, so the drugs actually they target the immune system, so that you can lead to immune suppression or lower immunity in patients who are treated with these drugs. So that can then lead to complications related to the lower immune system function.
So when we say that MS is an immune system dysfunction, is it an autoimmune kind of thing? Is the body attacking itself?
Right. So I think that's how it is understood so far, that MS is predominantly an autoimmune condition where we do not know what triggers the immune system to start acting again its own body. But clearly the immune system is activated and the drugs are immune. They are called immune modulators.
So I can see the issue here where you're trying to get the body to stop attacking itself, but it stops attacking everything else as well.
Not everything else, but definitely some of the key components of the immune system can become dysfunctional. That can then lead to, you know, complications. So we have to be very careful about managing these patients when they are on some of these, you know, highly effective but potentially risky therapies.
So is there a genetic component to that? I mean, if it's autoimmune, it sounds like there's something that the body is recognizing that it's overreacting. I mean, is there a genetic component to MS? If your parents had MS, are you likely to get it?
So it's not a genetic disease, as we know, so it's not passed on, like, you know, from parent to the child. However, there is slightly high risk of an offspring, you know, if the parents have or if siblings have had MS, so then they will have higher risk within the family, but the risk is not 100%.
All right, and there's no contagion. It can't be transmitted from person to person, I gather, right?
Not that we know of so far, no. There is no evidence of that yet.
We're talking to Dr. Vijay Yadav from Oregon Health Sciences University at the Multiple Sclerosis Center there about a number of things involving MS, including diet, which we'll get to in just a moment. If you have questions or comments or experiences you'd like to share with us, maybe you have MS, we would like to hear from you. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone. Send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So you've been focusing on diet for some time at the center at OHSU, and what sorts of approaches have you been taking?
I think my interest in diet started when I started my fellowship, which was way back in 2001. And the reason it was actually sort of appealing to me was patients were doing it, and then we were not really educated about that aspect. And then that Oregon is somewhat unique in a way because we had Dr. Swank here, who was one of the neurologists who had come up with this diet called Swank diet. And people were trying that. They were taking it for a long time, and they were vouching for like good efficacy of that without any drugs at that time. So, but on the other hand, when you look at the scientific evidence to look at what diet could be doing to MS, there was hardly any evidence. So I think that's what sort of triggered our interest in exploring the role of diet in MS. And we also know that there was some genetic predisposition to MS, but there are a lot of environmental factors which then make a person prone to be getting MS. So I think those missing links were the one that led us to sort of start exploring diet in MS.
That's really interesting, though. It sounds like the patients got out a little bit ahead of the medical community.
I think they are the ones, you know, who really teach us a lot. In fact, I learn from them every day in my clinic and, you know, my interaction with them. So I think they are the driving force behind whatever we do in our field.
That's great that you can learn from it. Is medicine still generally a little resistant? I mean, even in the age of the Internet, when people are always coming in saying, here's what I saw on WebMD, I mean, do some medical professionals still get their hackles up a bit about that?
You know, I think in this day and age, we'll be like foolish if we say that, you know, people are more educated. It is like it's an information boom here. So we have to be kind of constantly keep up ourselves updated as well. And I personally learn from patients a lot, so I do not mind at all, you know, if we are learning from them at any step. So, and, you know, you can't keep up with every possible thing that is happening, although we are constantly doing that. But it's good to learn from them.
Right. It's not just reading the medical journals anymore. There's a lot more out there to take a look at.
Exactly.
So let's talk about the actual dietary approaches. What sorts of diets seem to help people who have MS and MS symptoms?
So I think first thing I would like to point out is Dr. Swank's diet, or Swank diet, as most people know about it. So his approach was to basically lower the fat or saturated fat in the diet, and to the point, for example, the average caloric intake from fat should be less than 20% of your daily caloric intake. So that was his approach, and then he also added things like, in addition to cutting back on the saturated fat, cut back on red meat, but increase, say, fish intake and increase omega-3 or fish oil intake. So that was sort of his approach. And even though he has done studies, but they are not really as well designed as one would like to really go for, you know, solid evidence as we're looking for nowadays. But what he taught us, or his diet taught us, was that the patients who were following that diet, they did have improvement in their overall long-term disability as well as survival. So people who were, following his diet, they tended to live much longer than people who were not really following his diet. And this is a small study which was published. In fact, he did a 50-year sort of follow-up of his patients during this study. So that was one approach. Then subsequently, there have been many other sort of diets which have been looked at. The other one that we personally were doing the study here was based upon McDougall diet, which is also very low-fat diet, but it's a completely plant-based diet. So it's there is no meat. There is the amount of fat that we at least offered in the diet was closer to 10% of the total daily caloric intake. So these are very hard diet, can be challenging to really cut the fat to this level. But that was what we did, at least in the clinical trial that we did here at OHSU, which was a one-year trial. And then there are like paleo diet, which is also being kind of followed by Dr. Terry Walls. She herself is an internist who unfortunately has MS, and she kind of through her own experience figured out that this kind of diet may be beneficial. So they have done some small studies as well, which has shown some improvement in fatigue, for example. So, I mean, right now the data is very limited, so we can't really claim that, you know, diet can really change MS, at least, you know, in terms of disease activity or disability. But there are definite advantages to the people who are following the, some diets, like which is usually a healthy diet, which can improve fatigue, for example, I think is one big thing, which at least we saw in our trial as well as with Dr. Terry Wall's studies. So I think those are some of the big things which our patients suffer from and may benefit by following a low-fat diet or maybe a healthy diet in general, which can then improve, you know, fatigue and some of the other symptoms. For example, like, you know, a plant-based diet can improve your constipation and overall it improves your general health. So that will then lead to, because there is emerging data on general improvement of the health, for example, if you have improvement in your lipid profile, improvement in your weight or high blood pressure, that can all lead to improvement in MS. So these are emerging data at present time.
We're talking about MS, multiple sclerosis, and dietary approaches to curbing some of the effects of it with Dr. Vijay Yadav at Oregon Health Sciences University. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we continue this discussion. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone. The email address here is jx@jeffnet.org. You mentioned it could be a little hard to stay on these diets. Is it just hard to find food in copious amounts at a standard grocery store that would fit within the confines of this diet?
I think one needs to be educated for any diet that you're trying to follow. You know, you will have to have some kind of guidance where to. So, for example, like, you know, there are books, there are DVDs, there are, like, online information. But personally, what we learned from our experience when we were doing the clinical trial, that you need a lot of hand-holding and a lot of coaching to the patients. So we had dietitians who was constantly, like, you know, reminding the patients what they were eating. We were following what the patients were eating by, food questionnaires, so that we could follow. But on an average, you know, if you look at an average patient, you know, it's hard for them to be motivated to follow a strict diet. So you need some kind of constant motivation, and that's something which I feel is a barrier.
Did Dr. Swank's work lead to any sort of packaged foods? I mean, I wonder if there. I mean, because I think in terms of the Atkins diet now, there were things ending up with the Atkins label on them over time. Did anything like that emerge from the Swank diet?
I don't think the Swank diet led to any packaged food or like food delivery systems. But there were definitely textbook. I mean, there are books which were published by their. They have a website that people can follow. So I think mostly people have done on their own.
All right, let's talk, Dr. Yadav, about the differences then for the people who did go into the diets that were meant to reduce saturated fats and increase plant foods. I mean, were the differences between them and the people who hadn't adopted these diets fairly dramatic or somewhat subtle?
So I can talk about our study because I think that probably is the first randomized controlled trial of diet versus control.
Okay.
So when our subjects came into the study and they changed their diet this dramatically, within 1 month of changing the diet, they had improvement in their fatigue level significantly, which could not be explained by, like, say, weight loss, you know, because weight loss, if somebody has obesity and if they lose weight, they tend to have improvement in fatigue. But the diet itself, I thought, was quite impressive in just changing the fatigue. So something was changing in the body that led them to have improvement in the fatigue. And as the time went by, like as the 1 year went by, the weight was improving kind of steadily. And then on an average, they had about 20-pound weight loss in the study, in the subjects overall. But there were subjects who lost like 50 pounds, 60 pounds over the 1 year period. So I think there were changes that you could see as the diet was implemented.
But I imagine it's a little hard to pull those findings apart, though, to decide whether they felt better because of weight loss or felt better because of the diet generally.
But I think within the first month, as I said, you know, because there was not a significant change in the weight, but within that first month when the fatigue was improving significantly, I think there was something changing which we did not really capture because some of these things are hard to capture. For example, like, you know, we probably could have done some immune studies to look at if there was change in the immune system, or there are no markers as such right now that we can really test in the blood or, you know, somehow to assess what was changing.
All right. I think go ahead. I think we just answered a question here for Heidi in Mount Shasta, but I want to bring her into the conversation. Welcome to the exchange with Dr. Yadav.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Heidi.
What's on your mind?
Hi. Oh, I didn't know if you got my question already. I have been using a vegan diet for about 3 years. I was diagnosed with MS in 2002, and I was put on Copaxone for about 10 years, and then I actually took myself off, mostly because of insurance issues. And my daughter was eating vegan, and I just started eating vegan. And then I realized that what I really wanted to do was eat non-inflammatory foods. Mm-hmm. So I've been focusing my diet on low inflammation source foods. So I don't eat any red meat, or very rarely. And I know that there's some kind of an inflammation marker in a blood test, and that you can take. And I don't know what that is. I don't recall what it's. It's like an acronym with three letters. That is a normal, it's a typical blood test that you can take, and I'm wondering if that has ever been followed, inflammatory marker, has the inflammatory marker in blood tests been followed along with MS diet?
Okay. Comprehensive question. Thanks for that, Heidi.
Sure. So I think, Heidi, I'll answer that question. So the protein that you're talking about is probably C-reactive protein, or CRP. That's one of the general, systemic inflammation marker that we commonly use for patients who have, some kind of systemic inflammation, inflammatory disease, or sometimes we also use for patients who have cardiac disease, or the risk of, having somebody cardiac disease can be assessed by checking the C-reactive protein. So it is a marker of inflammation. For the diet study that we did, the plant-based diet that we did at OHSU, we did check the C-reactive protein, and that did show improvement, but the improvement was probably most prominent in the first 6 months, like around the six-month mark, it did show improvement. But then there is so much variation in the C-reactive protein. And for example, if somebody gets sick, when they are following the diet but they get sick, the general response of the body will be the C-reactive protein will go high. So it's so much variability that, you can't really use this marker as very kind of the marker, for inflammation. So it can be used to some extent, but it's not as effective as, one would want it to be.
All right. Our guest again is Dr. Vijay Yadav at Oregon Health Sciences University. We're talking about diet and its effects on multiple sclerosis, MS. You can join us at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Lee in Eugene writes, throughout my years, I've met a number of adults who developed MS who had in common a childhood of physical trauma, including sexual abuse. Have any studies been done to examine histories of MS patients regarding a possible delayed response to early physical trauma? The association is my own, but I think it is a valid theory when harm to a young person is so severe that the damaging consequences would be carried in the body throughout life and perhaps finally be expressed through the nervous system. So that's from Lee and Eugene. Your thoughts on that?
So I'm sorry about, the experience that, you've known so far. What I would say is stress in general can affect MS, and I'm not sure about the sexual trauma as such, but in general, any stress, whether it is emotional, physical, or any chronic stress can, we did not really used to believe that, by the way. This was, I would say probably 20 years ago or 15 years ago, we did not really believe that stress had any significant impact on MS, but as we continued to explore this more, and the research showed us that stress actually can affect MS adversely, and it can lead to disease activity. So there has been a very good study which was published in Neurology, which is one of the prominent journals in neurological field, that was looking exactly at this system, at this symptom, stress affecting the MS. And so they were doing MRIs, which is one of the imaging techniques that we are using routinely for MS management, and looking at disease activity. And that showed that people who had stress reduction therapy or stress management therapies versus who did not really have stress management therapy had higher level of disease activity. So people in the control group had a higher level of disease activity on the MRI versus people had the stress management therapy. So I think that relationship we are beginning to understand more, and the biology of the disease is such that, you know, I'm not surprised, and I won't be surprised that, you know, stress will lead to immune dysfunction, and then, but we have to kind of go at it from what the evidence has shown so far.
All right, yeah, I got to follow a physical trail there. There is some research, I understand, into a hypothesis of MS being delivered by a virus. How far along is that?
So that, I think we, actually, the researchers had spent, I would say, decades, you know, trying to explore whether there's a virus which, or there's one or more viruses which can then trigger the disease in any way. So far, we have not been able to prove, like, you know, one particular virus showing the cause effect. But at OHSU, we have been looking at one virus, which is called JME virus, or Japanese macaque encephalitis, encephalomyelitis virus, which is a virus which was detected in one of the monkey colonies, which is part of the OHSU Research Center, Primate Center. And MS usually does not affect, like, you know, primates. So to have MS-like disease in that colony, and now we are able to identify one virus from that, which may, again, it's a type of, it belongs to herpes virus virus group, and we are exploring that aspect right now, but there's no cause and effect detected so far, but that seems to be a promising area of research.
Still some work ahead, I see. I noticed studies on, back to the diet element of things, lipoic acid and its effects on MS. And is that being considered as a supplement, or is it found in some foods?
So it is found in foods. However, a food would be like, for example, the green vegetables or things like, you know, liver, and some of those meat products can have high amount of lipoic acid. But the lipoic acid that you need for possible MS management, you cannot really get that from diet alone. So you have to have, supplements will provide 1,000 times more what you can get from the diet alone. So at OHSU, we've been looking into lipoic acid as a MS treatment.
All right, more to come on that front for sure. A lot of good work going on at the medical, the Multiple Sclerosis Center at Oregon Health Sciences University, OHSU in Portland, where Dr. Vijay Sri Yadav works and is our guest on The Exchange. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Sure, thank you.
All right, take care.